Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to America's Most Haunted. This is Teresa Argee, the Haunted Housewife, and joining me soon will be my partner, Eric Olson, who has stepped away
soon.
For a second. Oh, there he is. Welcome.
Thank you.
And tell us who our guest is today for this very, very special edition.
God, this is an amazing battle with technology. My brain has exploded. I've had to clean the walls of my office numerous times. All right, having said all that, we finally welcome the great Albert Jack, author of Phantom Hitchhikers and Other Urban Legends, and actually many other similar books, which look all very interesting. I'm actually very eager to take a look at some of these other ones, because thus far, Phantom Hitchhikers is the only one I have. But again, the focus of that is on urban legends. Where do urban legends, conspiracy theories, and old wives' tales originate? And are any of them true? Have you heard the one about Walt Disney's frozen body? Does Coca-Cola own Santa Claus? Do alligators live in New York City sewers? Well, sometimes they do. That was an aside. More than just a collection of folklore, Phantom Hitchhikers and Other Urban Legends is also a detective story exploring the real events behind modern myths, proving that truth is often stranger than fiction. Albert Jack is an English writer and historian who spends a significant portion of his time, including right this freaking minute, in South Africa. And he became a publishing phenomenon in 2004 when his first book, Red Herrings and White Elephants, which explored the origins of well-known phrases in the English language, became an international bestseller. Welcome, Albert.
Wow, what an introduction. I thought you were just about to introduce Jeffrey Archer or somebody. Good Lord, who wrote that?
That is modified from your own PR, to be frank.
Oh, my PR people wrote that, did they? I understand now.
But I never read anything plain. I always modify it.
Good for you.
I'm a born modifier. And hello, Teresa, to you. So, again, we apologize to everyone who's checked in the other 11 times we've tried to start the show. But we do finally have it figured out. And just in case you're interested, just as a side note, a technological note, we were bringing Albert in via Skype because he is in South Africa. And, of course, international phone calls coming from South Africa would be rather prohibitive for an entire hour. So we've been working on this whole Skype thing. We ran into all kinds of different issues and software compatibility and so on and so forth. So it just shows you that even a platform that is now as mature as Blog Talk Radio, which it is, and it is very stable, it works really well. We've been doing this show since July, last July, and we really have not had any tech problems until now. And
but you haven't tried to contact South Africa, the third world country with the internet speed of a
right.
But we're
getting
there.
We're running around without legs, killing their girlfriend.
That's another news story. Do you want to talk about that?
God, yeah, I want to get to that because I'm an Olympic nut. You know, I've actually been to several of the Olympics, and it's a family thing. It's become more prohibitive lately, so we haven't gone to the last couple as a huge family group. But we had as many as 20 people from our family together for Seoul in 2000. And so anyway, yeah, we watched it really, really religiously. And, you know, what an inspirational story. Here's this guy. He's got no freaking legs. And he's running with the legged people in the Olympics. He's a handsome guy and he's well-spoken and all this. And good God, it turns out he's a loon.
Well, clearly. I mean, he had it all, didn't he? And he's just lost it all in the space of, what was it, a mad half hour or something like that. I mean, the whole story, I didn't realize for a minute that you had picked it up probably in America there, but it's obviously a huge story down here, and the guy's been given bail now, and the clowns of the South African justice system, and, you know, he did do it. I mean, there's no doubt he did do it. It's just a question of whether it was absolutely deliberate or whether it was an accident. Or, you know, I've heard strange sounds in my house before, and I live on a gated community in South Africa too, and we have guards. Just the same as that. And, you know, if you do have your window being, you know, you don't go shooting through it first. You just check that there's somebody not there that's supposed to be there. You know, I don't come down into my house, and hear the bathroom, downstairs bathroom being used and start firing bullets into it in case it's my girlfriend's in there. You know, let's be serious about this. It's an absolutely ridiculous story. And the guy goes and gets bailed. What does that tell you?
It's preposterous. I'll tell you the most interesting thing I read about it, and it was from a U.S. lawyer, and he said, "I'll tell you what's going to happen. He is going to get, a plea bargain on this because number one, there are all kinds of break-ins. South Africa has a terrible break-in problem, so that part is perfectly plausible. Number two, how on earth are they going to prove that he did it on purpose?" You know, I mean, on the surface, it seems so obvious. Who else could have been in there? She wasn't in the bedroom anymore. She wasn't in bed. Where could she be? I hear a sound in the bathroom. My logical first thought would be, it's my girlfriend. I'm not going to shoot four bullets into there. But, you know, we're talking about the law here, and you got to prove that he did it on purpose. And
well, we're talking about South African law, Eric, and all they've got. Here's the question: was it premeditated? Did he do it deliberately? Did he mean it? In which case, he gets life in jail. If he didn't, and it was an accident, therefore it's a misdemeanor, it's a gun crime. He'll still get 15 years manslaughter. He still goes to jail. Why is he on bail?
Because they're being exceptionally, exceptionally careful about it, and they want to make sure. The way it appeared here is they were going out of their way to not give him any particular benefit of the doubt given his celebrity status at first. Then once in the court setting, it appeared that they were being extremely careful, you know, to follow the letter of the law and to make sure there wasn't a possibility that anything from the defendant's standpoint was being violated or even compromised. So, I mean, it was hilarious. I heard, they had it on CNN here, we heard the, the judge's speech, and my God, he reiterated English common law history. I mean, talk about covering all the bases. So,
You know what it is, don't you? Of course, it's that old story, and you suffer it in America too, and we do too in Great Britain, and it's no different here. It's money talks.
Well, of course. All right, let's get back to that because it's fascinating, and talk about, you know, ultimately it's how the mighty have fallen and how quickly, and like you said, here's a guy who literally had it all, and the future, my God, I mean, it was just open ended and unlimited, and he has, you know, literally shot himself out of that, regardless of what happens. I mean, clearly the sponsorships are going away. You know, his celebrity status is permanently changed. I think a reasonable comparison would be O.J. Simpson, and look what's happened to him.
Well, this was exactly the story that was going on around here in South Africa, is that when Oscar was insisting or claiming that he wanted to be treated like any other able-bodied athlete, who knew he meant O.J. Simpson?
That's good. Yeah, it's sad. It's sad. And I personally actually took it really hard because I thought he was a tremendous story. What an inspirational story, you know, to any number of people. Anyone with any disability, anyone who thinks that they, due to some inherent quote-unquote defect, you know, cannot achieve his success, just absolutely, you know, buoyed anyone along those lines. It's really, really inspirational, and I think he really struck a chord around the world. I mean, not just South Africa.
Yes, he did. But let me tell you just another quick side to that character that we know down here in South Africa. It's reported locally, but not internationally. He was in a restaurant not long ago, within the last 3 or 4 months. And I know this restaurant. It's a place called Melrose Arch in Johannesburg. It's a very expensive area, so don't think third world, you know, shanty towns here. This is a very upmarket part of a very civilized city. And he got thrown out for letting a gun off. He shot a gun. He fired it in the restaurant.
That seems insane.
Imagine doing that in New York or Boston in a posh restaurant. He fired it.
You would not get away with that.
and they covered it all up and kept it quiet. It only came out now in local news because people who were in the restaurant said, hey, look, this guy's not really that sane, eh? This is why.
So, well, I also heard there were other, in retrospect, looking back, there have been other incidents of rage, of irrational anger. And this was clearly a guy who had a really bad temper and couldn't control it.
Sure.
All right, so yeah, let's talk about your book, Phantom Hitchhikers and Other Urban Legends.
Yeah,
Teresa,
let's talk about me for a change.
Teresa, why don't you kick things off with the book?
Well, I was telling Albert before we went on air that I had to literally hide the book from my daughter, who is, she just loves it. And she's 11, but she's a very, very intelligent 11.
Oh, she's 11?
Yeah, she's 11, but she's a super smart girl. But she's, I keep catching her reading the book. I'm like, put it down and do your homework. She loves it. She thinks the stories are so interesting. And then she wants to find out more about them. And she's all into science and logic and a lot of history, too. So it's what I like about the book is there's a little bit of everything. And while I was reading the book, I was literally walking down memory lane. Remember some of these stories, these urban legends from my childhood. And
yep.
Some of the ones, the one that that struck me, and you might remember this, Eric, too, where I live in
Cleveland,
Ohio.
You mean because
I'm
old?
Yes, because you're old like me. There was a summer camp that I went to. So summer camps are breeding grounds for these type of stories, you know, campfire tales and girls sitting around telling stories. And the story about the hook, you know, the man with the hook and the couple out parked their car in the woods. And those stories, and boy, I distinctly remember hearing that story being told to me by a counselor, and my cabin mates were too scared to go out, and of course I wasn't because I wasn't afraid of these things, and I didn't really believe them. And we walked from our camp to a place called Squire's Castle, which is an old brick structure that's kind of shaped like a castle, and it has its own legend and its own history to us. And, you know, I swear our imagination was getting to us, and I made it all the way there, and nobody would come with me, and I waited back. But on the way back, I swear I could hear that hook man chasing me down in the woods. And we thought, and growing up, we thought that this was a local legend, that this was something very very specific to our area, especially the area I was in. But here it's not. These are international legends.
Absolutely. Here's the point. Here's the whole point of an urban legend. They do the rounds. They go round and round. They could have happened anywhere at any time. They could have one time you'll hear the story and it happened in some town in Australia. Another time, the time I heard that hook hand story, it was actually in France when I first heard it. I wasn't in France. I heard it happened in France.
Mm-hmm.
Down the road from a lunatic asylum. They can be set anywhere. This is what makes them urban legends. You know, they may be true. It's something that somebody told somebody that told somebody that told somebody, and by the time it's been heard for the third or fourth time, hey, goddamn, we believe it.
And where do they originate? I mean, where, like, I don't know about that specific one, but where does it start? Where does the original story come from? And is there a shred of truth to it, or is this just a story that's literally made up to excite a reaction out of people?
No. But listen, most of them, apart, as I was just talking to Eric off air before we came on, most of them, apart from the ghost stories, unless you believe in ghosts, most of these could have happened. You know, there is a newspaper report of there being albino crocodiles in the sewers of New York, because back in the 40s and 50s, when the jet set thing started happening and people started flying around, they would, you know, on holidays, the great and the good and the wealthy of New York would go down and buy these exotic little creatures, these little alligators in Florida, bring them back to New York. And when they got too big, they'd flush them down the toilet. So they all started, now they were no longer sort of 6, 7, 8 inches long. They were getting too big. They got flushed down the toilet. And apparently there was an alligator problem in the sewers down there. And there's a newspaper report that I found from the 1950s where the guy in charge had to get his men down there with rifles and shoot them all. I mean, whether it's true or not, I'm not saying that is true, but it could be, couldn't it?
Yeah.
That's the point of urban legend.
And that's a frightening thought, because, you know, I remember hearing that one as well, and you're almost afraid to use the bathroom because you never know what's going to come out and literally bite you on the butt.
Well,
that was... And that was the story, and it's on the book, you know, it's on the title of the book, and that was the one that my daughter was like, are there alligators in the sewer? And I said, well, I don't know. So there could be. And so that's what got her originally like, oh, I got to read this book, and she just was dying to know. And we spend time in Florida. That's where we go on vacation. So I don't like alligators. I lived in Florida. They were around me all the time. To me, they're like a menace. I don't like them at all. They frighten me. But
well,
I just,
what thrilled me about what you said there is that something that I've written has actually got 11-year-old to pick up a book. Remember those old-fashioned things? A book and started reading it. But going back to, and that's a real thrill for me, so thanks for that. But going back to whether they're true or not, I mean, some of the rock and roll legends that, because I cover all sorts of different subjects, you know, those common ones that you just mentioned, the hooked hand and the phantom hitchhiker and the alligators and the sewer and so on. But then, of course, there's the big ones. Do you remember the story of Van Halen and how they apparently had a miniature fit and smashed up their dressing room in the 1980s because they expressly insisted that there should be no brown M&Ms backstage in their guest suite? They had all sorts of other colours, but no brown ones. And if there are any brown ones, there was going to be trouble. Now, that sounds really kind of Spinal Tap to me, huh? And probably to most other people. But it turns out that was actually true.
It is true. A lot of my background is music, is, you know, writing about or covering or doing radio and whatnot. So one way or another. And I've always been interested in, there's a number of bands, it's more in the past now because it has been publicized, but there are all kinds of acts that had all kinds of strange writers, is what they're called, in their contracts. And yes, the Van Halen one is always held up as, man, this, how could that be true? But it is true, you know? I've never heard why. Do you know why they didn't want the brown one?
I do.
Well, I do, but you can tell the story, Eric.
Well, here's I got something to add to that. Believe it or not, when I was in college, I was a production assistant for bands when they would come into town when I went to school in Cincinnati. Van Halen was one of the bands I worked with. There's more to it than just removing brown M&Ms. I would have to fill their whiskey bottles with iced tea. And I also had to keep band members out of the production office so they weren't calling their bookies all day. There were all sorts of crazy things they did, and I asked their manager, why are they making us do this? And his answer was, because they can.
But do you know why they wanted all the brown M&Ms out of the bowl?
No.
Neither of you do. Okay. Well,
no.
Van Halen were one of the first big type of station acts. Fallout riders would consist of a case of beer and a few clean towels. But when they started playing the big stadiums with the rooftop, the lighting and the sound systems and everything, these contracts for these promoters started becoming sort of like 300-400 pages thick. They have to provide certain things. So what the lead singer did, and he actually talks about it in his autobiography, he decided that he made up this really stupid, simple little writer request. If he ever walked back in to the backstage area and found brown M&Ms in the bowl, he knew that the contract hadn't been read. That meant check everything. That meant check the plug sockets were in the right place. That meant check everything was safe. That meant just check the entire contract. Because that one little clause hadn't been noticed and hadn't been read, and therefore he didn't believe any of it had.
You know, that makes perfect sense. It's actually quite logical, and as you were saying it, I had a vague recollection of that being true. On the technical side, because we're doing Skype, please do try to keep as close as possible. You're drifting a little bit there in talking about Van Halen, and we want to hear every word.
Okay, well, I'm getting a little bit of echo back here, so I'm doing my best. We'll keep trying. I want to keep on.
Okay. That what you just last said sounded perfect. No problems. Yeah, that's a great point. So I mean, it made sense. So it wasn't anything specific about brown M&Ms. It was proving that the writer, in fact, had been read and was being more or less adhered to. And that makes good sense because on the technical side, you know, you get a band like Van Halen, and they have certain very specific needs technically. And I know the farther back you go in time, promoters and people putting on concerts, you know, it's like, screw these guys. I mean, we're going to give them the equipment we give them. We don't care if they're happy about it. What are they going to do? Not play? So, you know, it was the balance of power. It's kind of like with between management and labor. You know, in the old days, there were very good reasons why labor, the rise of the labor movement, was so important, because workers had no power. They had no say. So there.
I think artists were the perfect example of that, wasn't it? Remember the old agents of the 50s and 60s, just get on there, son, and perform. Just go on there and dance around and I'll look after the money, you know, just do your job.
Exactly. And of course, all of the publishing issues, all these songwriters, you know, losing their ownership of their songs to people like, and I don't want to necessarily pick on Dick Clark, but he was one of them, whose name was routinely added in co-songwriting credits, even though they had nothing to do with it. Because, look, if you put my name on there as a co-writer, then you're out, man. I'm not going to put you on American Bandstand. And I don't want to particularly pick on Dick, because he wasn't even anywhere near the most egregious of the violators. But many of these people, you know, that's why the history of popular music, and it's not just popular music, it's popular entertainment, you know, and on, is filled with such spotted characters. Because on the one hand, sure, you know, they really did give these artists an opportunity. They really did believe in them enough to record them, and sure, they helped them out personally. A lot of those guys, especially farther back you go, the old blues guys and the jazz guys, they had a lot of personal problems. There's no doubt about it. And they had substance abuse problems, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, you can view it as a paternalistic type thing, which obviously it was. But so my point is there's two sides to everything. And
well, you make a good point. And another side to that slightly, on the positive side, is you take Lennon and McCartney. You know, Lennon and McCartney always shared songwriting credits, but very rarely, if ever, did they ever sit down and write a song together. It was just agreed that every song they put together would have a Lennon-McCartney writing. They would share it, they'd share the royalties, share the credit.
Exactly right. And look how well it served them. Although, I don't know, has there been any talk ever? I've read a lot of the biographies. I'm certainly a huge Beatles fan. I don't remember specifically seeing anything about if that led to any resentment.
Yes, it did. It did in the end, very recently, in fact. Paul McCartney obviously wasn't thinking straight. I think it was during his marriage with Heather, whatever her name was, but he decided to sue, and he wanted to change the songwriting credit round on everything to read McCartney and Lennon.
That's right.
Instead of Lennon and McCartney, and it caused an awful lot of bitterness between him and Yoko Ono, which they have now resolved, but yeah, it did backfire, of course, in the end.
Right. Well, I remember, too, a similar arrangement, you know, other lesser-known writers have had similar arrangements. I remember Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. I know he and I forget which member, maybe Gaudio. Anyway, one of the other members, they had a similar arrangement where, regardless of who wrote it, you know, they both got credit for it.
Sure.
And they seem to have remained, you know, friendly for life. But anyway, yeah. It's interesting. It's the balance of power is really ultimately what we were talking about. And, you know, the reason that that some of these ridiculous writers came into play was just what you were saying. You know, part of it was a power play and whatnot, but there were also legitimate underlying reasons why they wanted to make sure that the promoters or the venues or whoever was responsible for carrying these things out were in fact doing what they were supposed to do, because it did have actual real world consequence. It wasn't just a bunch on the technical side, especially. So
that's how that particular Van Halen urban legend that everyone thinks, well, what a bunch of clowns, what a stupid way to behave. Actually, it's quite a clever way to check the contract's been read, isn't it? That urban legend was strictly true. And also staying on urban legends as well, on rock and roll, I've been reminded so many times of the times that Keith Moon allegedly drove his Rolls Royce into a swimming pool. I think even Oasis had a picture of a Rolls Royce submerged into a swimming pool on one of their album covers, didn't they?
Yeah.
That's a classic urban legend. But when I looked into that particular one and found out all the details, the hotel they were staying in where it was supposed to have happened, I can't remember now if it was Las Vegas or Los Angeles, but it's in the book, certainly. Well, the swimming pool in that particular hotel is on the fourth floor. So that can't be true, can it?
No. Hey, Teresa, have we lost you?
I can't hear everything. I'm hearing my own voice echoing, and I can't hear Albert at all. So I don't know if it's my phone. I'm just trying to listen as best I can, but I'm having a difficult time hearing.
Why don't you hang up and call back in?
Okay.
We'll try it that way. All right. Well, as we were talking about a little bit earlier, Albert, this show being America's Most Haunted, we are particularly interested in any of the paranormal aspects of the legends, and we're interested to kind of hear about those specific stories, but then also anything, any background you're able to find out, and any historical confirmation or otherwise on any of these tales.
Well, you and I have already disagreed on this, because there are a couple of ghost stories in there. There's the famous Phantom Hitchhiker story. That's what the book's called. Of the guy, he's either on a motorbike or he's in a car or he's in a truck, and he finds a girl in a very distressed state in the middle of nowhere in a dark lane somewhere miles from any town. So he stops to help, and she explains that she's arguing with her boyfriend or husband, and he threw her out of the car, and now she needs to get home, and blah, blah, blah. So she hitchhikes a lift, Phantom Hitchhiker. He takes her home, drops her off, and when he gets to his own house, he then realizes she's left her coat or blanket or whatever part of the story you've heard before in the back of his car. So he thinks, no problem, I'll take it back the following morning on my way back to work. And as he gets there and knocks on the door and it asks for the girl's name, whoever it is, I think I called her, I think in my story I named her after the name of a friend of mine in England. I can't remember who it was now, to be honest. That'll please her if she's listening.
It's immaterial in the real world.
Exactly, because it's made up anyway. So he goes back and knocks on the door and says, you know, I picked your daughter up last night, I just wanted to check she was okay. And that's when the guy reveals that she was actually killed in an accident on that bend, on that park road, about 3 years ago, and she's been trying to get home ever since, and he's always having people knocking on his door saying, I brought your daughter home last night, here's her jacket, or whatever. I don't know if that fits into the paranormal theme of the program, or whether anybody would really believe that. I don't know. I don't, to be honest. I just think it's a made-up story.
Well, Teresa, are you back?
I am back.
Excellent. Are you hearing okay now?
So far, so good, yes.
All right. Did you hear what Albert just said?
I know he was talking about the story of the Phantom Hitchhiker, and which is a great story, and that is a legendary ghost story that I've seen and heard many different versions of it. So
exactly.
It's, yeah.
We think, and I will not speak for Teresa, even though I think I could. The reason that is an archetypal story, and that we've heard it, you know, if you watch the various shows, and that's kind of how I got into this whole paranormal world, was actually covering it from the media standpoint. I've actually become more and more interested in it as a real world, quote unquote, phenomena, and actually come to believe, quote unquote, and I'm happy to discuss what that means too, but I've become much more of a believer.
I'd like to discuss what that means. What do you mean by quote unquote? Do you actually believe that that may have happened or has happened?
Oh, I think absolutely something like that has happened many, 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 many times. I think that's
really
an archetypal spirit type behavior. I think that is recreating something that's really fundamental and primal. And I think that if there are spirits, and I'm at the point where one in some version or another, I do believe that there are spirits. And the other thing is, I am a reasonably religious person. I mean, I grew up a Lutheran. I am still a Lutheran. I'm not great about going to church, but I don't question and probably never really have fundamentally questioned the underlying beliefs of Christianity and in particular Lutheranism, which is just, you know, the flavor I happen to be born in. So these beliefs.
Yeah, but the flavor you happen to be born in is to me a little like saying our family are lifelong New York Knicks fans, and we always will be because we always have been, and that's what I was taught to believe in when I grew up, and I will never be anything else, or I'll always be a Chelsea fan or a Man United fan.
It's,
I mean,
exactly,
I can understand
exactly
it being part of the culture, but it doesn't mean it necessarily, you know.
It's true, you mean?
Yeah, that's what I said. I don't think it necessarily means it's true. And it opens up a whole wide spectrum. I mean, I've covered this before when I did crop circles and in one of my books called Loch Ness Monsters and Other Mysteries and Are They True or Not?
Yes, we absolutely want to talk about that too. Just to finish my thought.
Sure.
I do think there is something. What exactly it is, I'm not sure. But there is something called, that can be identified as, a spiritual plane. There is some form of energy. There's some form of entity that exists on that plane. I do believe that plane and our world as we experience it, there is some form of intersection, and there are at least times when they align. And
there's a parallel universe going on. There's another society living in a slightly different time. I mean, this goes back to fiction. This goes back to the time machine. And you could argue about the Philadelphia experiment with the moving of the ship from New York to the Philadelphian harbor. Quantum physics. Can you really break something up that's solid and move it? And people can actually see it. Well, guess what? Yeah, you know, you can. I mean, David Copperfield actually made the New York Statue of Liberty disappear in front of millions of people and TV cameras.
Well,
it can happen.
But he used sleight of hand. I'm talking about something that's actually real.
I think exactly the same.
You think what? I'm sorry, you were breaking up.
I think it's exactly the same. I think it's sleight of hand and belief systems can confuse us. I mean, I wrote quite an in-depth piece about Bigfoot and about whether Bigfoot exists. And, you know, there are Bigfoot societies of Ohio and Texas and Unicorn's website. And I think the Rockefeller Foundation has even funded a university investigation into whether Bigfoot exists.
We're deeply involved in Bigfoot. We know all about Bigfoot.
Absolutely. Well, you know more than me, I guess. But there are so many sightings. So many people have said, absolutely convincingly, I believe this, I saw that. I'm talking in the thousands, maybe even in the tens of thousands.
Oh, I think it is in the tens of thousands, yeah.
Okay, but you know what? All of these so-called experts have got as much evidence, and I mean real scientific evidence, of the existence of a big, hairy, half-simian, Bigfoot-type creature, or Sasquatch, as it was called, as I have right here on my desk.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? How can it be real?
This is my point.
If there's no evidence.
This is my point. This is the thing with the ghost stories and religion and with the Loch Ness Monster and with the Bigfoot. If you're the one that's making the claim, you have to provide the evidence. That's the way society works. I don't have to prove it isn't true. You have to provide some sort of credible evidence to prove it is. And in Bigfoot's case, there's no DNA, tooth, nail, bone, anything at all that has ever been associated with anything other than a creature we already know exists, like a bison or a bear.
There is some ambiguity. I would argue, I mean, do you think all of the footprints, all of those are fake?
Yes, I do, and I can tell you that a lot of them are done deliberately for fun.
Well, sure,
I mean,
are they all fake?
There are as many people out there screwing with Bigfoot followers and believers as there are people making patterns in wheat fields who are screwing with the minds of crop circle believers. They're just having fun. They're hopeless. There's millions of them, as many as there are believers. Believe me, it's a battle of will.
I have no doubt believing that accounts for some sizable portion. And I have no doubt that, I mean, obviously this is the crux of the entire quote unquote, you know, paranormal issue. So this is very fundamental stuff we're talking about. In my mind, Teresa's, you know, farther even into the assumption, and again, I don't want to speak for her, and I want to be quiet here in a minute so she can talk, but just to give my personal perspective on this, I think much of what is held up as paranormal evidence, whether it be we're talking ghosts, whether we're talking cryptozoology, which would include, of course, Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, I am not convinced of. There's not enough there. There is actually quite a bit of quote-unquote evidence for Bigfoot, depending on how you define evidence. But moving on beyond that. And then the third, of course, triangle, I guess, third point of the triangle of the broadly speaking paranormal would be the whole UFO world. I am less convinced about UFOs than I am about even Bigfoot or...
Well, I mean, again, I covered UFOs, and I can tell you, and we all have been treating it, you've been very, very patient, but I can tell you that, you know, you've got this whole Roswell incident. You've got this Area 51, haven't you? And they supposed to have a little spaceship there, and there's photographs of it, and there was the alien autopsy, and everybody, I think, is familiar with. Well, you know, thanks now to the Hubble telescope, okay, we now know what exists out in space to a distance that will take us 75,000 years to reach in the fastest craft we currently have. That's how far we can see out into space now. And there is nothing living out there. Doesn't mean there's anything, there's nothing outside that. I'm not saying I'm not a believer. In fact, I really hope there are other civilized societies somewhere in the universe. But we do know for sure they didn't make it all the way here in that tin can they found at Roswell with the ladder and the little bubble and the little dials. You know, the one that we've seen the photograph of that looks like Buck Rogers used to use.
Of course.
That is not true. We now know that. They couldn't have done that. But it doesn't mean there isn't something out there that we just haven't found yet.
I agree. As I was saying, I agree. The UFO is the area where I'm least convinced. But in looking at what we are calling evidence, okay, just to circle back around and close the loop on my worldview, because that's kind of how we started this part of the discussion, I do think that there is enough physical quote unquote scientific evidence in the form of EVPs, in other words, audio recordings, and in video form, and that those are then corroborated with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of personal experiences with the, for lack of a better term, the spirit world, that's the area I am most convinced of. And the only reason I brought up religion is I was simply saying that belief is not contradicted and in some ways is supported by my personal religious belief. So
yeah, but how about your personal experiences?
I have had paranormal experiences. They to me are more real than anything else I have ever experienced in terms of how they. Now, was it possible? There's two really key fundamental experiences. They could both, from a description standpoint, they could be explained away probably through the sleep paralysis phenomenon, but I don't think that's what it was. It was so real, so vivid, so specific, and my mother, who was 200 miles away at the time, had the exact same experience at the exact same time. And the core, the one experience that stands way above any of the others that I've had, not that I've had, you know, tons and tons, it's a handful. But that one experience, my mother and I had the exact same experience at the exact same time, as best we could reckon, because it was the middle of the night, that my grandmother, who was 2,500 miles away. We were both in Ohio. She was in California. She died. She had a heart attack and died. My mother had the exact same experience at the exact same time, at the time that it was calculated that she had the heart attack and died. So
that, you know, that I mean, I respect that, but that's also not uncommon, isn't it? We've all heard stories of twins, for example, who have had the same feelings and experiences, and they've been many, many miles apart. There must be something in that, I guess.
Yeah.
That's hard to explain, though, isn't it?
You're right. I think that experience is probably more related to some form of ESP, which to me is not anti-scientific at all. You know, it's just another form of energy that we just don't understand yet.
Absolutely. And there's plenty of those that we still don't understand yet. But going back to this Bigfoot, this urban legend Bigfoot belief that you were talking about, hundreds of thousands and perhaps even millions. Well, you know, I'll choose my words carefully here because I am respectful with people's beliefs. But there are also hundreds of thousands of people that believe in Father Christmas. Okay, they're not fully formed yet. They're still probably under 8 years old. There are millions of people that believe in the Loch Ness Monster. There are billions of people that believe that when they die, and I'm talking about over in Asia here and in the east of this world, that when they die, they'll, in a certain way, they'll go to heaven with 72 virgins in the Garden of Eden or whatever, actually believe that. I mean, these belief systems are, I don't know if problem's the right word, and that's the most important part here. People actually believe that there is millions of people. In this day and age, almost everybody has a recorder and a camera on their telephone. Don't tell me that everybody that's encountered a Bigfoot didn't happen to have his telephone or his camera with him at that particular time. All those millions of people you're talking about. It's just not believable.
I agree. That's a core problem. I am not without problems regarding specifically Bigfoot. I actually go back and forth pretty often over the median. On the one hand, it kind of is like, what argument did I last hear? You know what I mean? On the one hand, how could all of the – I mean, I can summarize it very, very quickly. On the one hand is basically what you said. Why is there no A, body? That's the most obvious.
It's pretty as one.
Right. And why is there no fossil record? That's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to be alive. They could be dead. Why is there no fossil record?
We've got fossil records that go back billions of years, but no Bigfoot.
I agree. That's a big problem. And so on and so forth. Just the relative lack of evidence. No question.
We're partially agreeing. I'm kind of applying that same sort of thought process to much of the paranormal claims that we have.
I understand that. And there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
And I don't, in theory, disagree with you. What I'm saying is I think, and where I was talking about millions, I was specifically talking about ghosts. I wasn't talking about Bigfoot. I think that enough people throughout history have had enough experiences with what, for lack of a better term, you would call ghosts or spirits, et cetera, spiritual entities. And the volume is such that I think there has to be something there beyond pure self-deception.
But that's my argument, Eric. That's the problem. The volume of it is. You know, I'm sitting here. Let me give you an example here. I'm sitting here with a nice glass of, or a half a glass of whiskey now. If I poured 100 glasses of whiskey into a big beaker, okay, which means there's more and more evidence, there's more and more of it. It doesn't make it any stronger or any more believable. It's still the same thing. There's just more of it. You see what I mean? You can have millions and millions and millions of claims. Do you know there was an experiment done in America, actually, I read a couple of, maybe many years ago, maybe a few decades ago, where they were investigating alien abduction. And they took all these people that had claimed to have been abducted. There's a very famous case in the 50s where, I forget her name now, but this lady claimed that aliens are going to come and save her religious cult from the planet and take them off to a new place called Clarion, which was behind the moon, so no one on the Earth could see it. It was all very believable in the 50s when spacemen were a big thing. Anyway, so they did this experiment idea of abduction. And they took all the people who had claimed to have been abducted by aliens and listened to their stories, okay? And then they took a bunch of people who never made any such claim, asked them to imagine it, and then hypnotized them. And you know what? They all came up with the same stories. They all had the same experiences.
Believe me, I have no problem understanding and sympathizing with your perspective. And I believe that self-deception, mass, you know, people are easily persuadable. I've looked pretty deeply into the whole sensory perception issue where it's really our brains that create reality. It's not
absolutely. Reality. That's exactly it.
But I still think there's something rather than nothing there on the ghost side. I am on the fence on Bigfoot. It really depends on the day of the week. UFOs, I think pretty similar to you. I think if you just look at the pure numbers involved, it is, and especially with all the stuff they're just finding day after day after day with, you know, looks like on Mars, as just NASA announced a day or two ago, it looks like, you know, that Mars had the right situation to support life at one point in time. Finding all these planets everywhere. So it seems to me that life is probably more prevalent than we had realized. Most of it is probably very, 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 very primitive. But if you just look at the numbers, the statistics, the trillions, trillions of stars that are out there in the universe, it is likely that there is some form of advanced life somewhere, somehow. I think
it's probable. I mean, even on our own planet, and we can come back to this global warming myth that we talked about earlier as well, even on our own planet, there wasn't really any life, so to speak, on Earth. As recently as, well, I say recently, I mean in terms of the perspective of the universe, as recently, something like 60 million years ago or something like that, when we were experiencing the ice age and the whole planet was covered in ice. Well, of course, as things changed and the sun started melting around the equator, and of course, the ice started melting all the way across, imagine the spiral, in effect, like peeling an apple, if you like. The ice melted over hundreds and hundreds of thousands or millions of years until all you've got left, even 6,000 years ago, Canada was still covered in ice. But now what you've got left is polar ice caps. And yes, of course, they're breaking up. It's still happening. It's still the defrosting of the ice age. That doesn't mean there's any global warming going on.
That's a process we've been going through. That I'm probably not ready to get into. But having said all that I've said, I really need to turn it over to Teresa because I would like her to express her worldview.
Well, I don't know. All I know is that when it comes to ghosts, when it comes to that aspect of the paranormal, I don't have any doubts. I also don't need evidence shown to me or proven to me by society or by anybody else because I have had my own experiences, not while sleeping, while awake, and not just one or two, but many. So I don't have any doubts there is something that we are currently referring to as ghosts paranormal.
Why do you think that you've had many? And I do respect your view. I'm very, very respectful about this because I'm fascinated by these subjects. Why do you think you've had many, 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 and Eric's had one too, and I've had none?
Well, for one thing, I look for them because that's what I do. I'm an investigator. That's I have dedicated my life to that, so that's what I do. And another thing is, just because we are calling them ghosts right now, and we're experiencing something, I cannot define what that something is. It is something that right now we are referring to as paranormal, and we're referring to as basically as ghosts. Just because we can't explain something doesn't mean there isn't an explanation for that. I think it's kind of arrogant for us as a species to think we know everything. And just because something can't be understood or explained or defined doesn't mean that there isn't an explanation for it. Just like
I think you're absolutely right.
A couple hundred years ago, we thought. Just look at how we used to think about that the Earth, that the Sun revolved around the Earth, and that you know, that the earth was flat and that germs were witchcraft. I mean, that wasn't that long ago. So just because we don't have an explanation for something.
We didn't understand electricity very
exactly.
recently. We didn't understand electricity at all.
We still can't explain gravity very much. So, I mean, there are things we can't understand. We don't know everything, but I do know that I'm not faking things. I do know that I'm not hallucinating. I do know that things have happened to me that I believe have happened. I don't know. I can't explain what they are, but I know that there is something there. So I don't have any doubts. When it comes to Bigfoot, it's entertaining.
I
don't know anything about that.
And I respect that totally, and I think I agree with everything you've just said, but you do know that you are going to have to be able to explain that for everybody to believe it. This is what happened with electricity. This is what happened with gravity. Finally, we found out a way of explaining it, understanding it, and you believing in it is wonderful, and I kind of want to as well, although I must admit I don't, but I'd like to. It needs to be explained to me.
Sure. I get it. Teresa, I'm curious because I don't know if I've ever really heard you, you know, exactly say how you feel about you know, the cryptids and UFOs. I'm interested in hearing that.
Oh, well, when it comes to Bigfoot, I haven't seen anything that sways me to believe that they're even similar to that. But then again, I don't know. I've never looked for Bigfoot. I've really never met anybody who's convincingly told me that they have seen or experienced a Bigfoot. But that being said, who's to say we know everything that's out there? I don't know every species and every creature that's out there. I think it's highly unlikely that there is something like Bigfoot-like out there that we haven't discovered. Highly unlikely doesn't mean impossible. When it comes to most cryptids, I feel that way. But again, we don't know everything. When it comes to UFOs, I've never seen one. I've never experienced one. But I know how vast the universe is. And I think, again, mm-hmm. it's very arrogant of us to think we are the only thing out there. And just because, like you said, Albert, that spaceship that they supposedly found in Roswell could never have made it through the cosmos and traveled this far, we're thinking that with right now with our knowledge base, with our knowledge of how space travel works. That doesn't mean that's the only way that things can travel intergalactically. So I don't know. I think that it would be a waste of space, of life, of anything for us to be the only people here. The only living people, the only beings out there. So I think that there's more likely a chance of life out there in the universe than there is a Bigfoot, that's for sure. And when it comes to ghosts, I have no doubt. But again, I don't know, is that something that, am I just perceiving that? Is that my mind making my body see, feel, hear these things? And what's causing that? Maybe we will find a scientific cause for that. But I know that there is something there, and I can't explain it. And there are just too many unanswered questions, but I've had too many experiences that I don't have any doubts at all. I can't explain exactly what it is, but I do believe in ghosts and spirits and the afterlife and all that. I can't explain it, but I believe that it is. And I don't need anybody to prove it to me. I don't need society to prove it to me. So.
I think that's fascinating, I value your point of view, and it's lovely to talk to you about it. I really do. I would like to believe it too. I'm not. Are you frightened of them?
I am not frightened of it. I have been in the past. I've experienced things that have frightened me, but that's mostly because I don't understand them. And the more I get into it, I feel more comfortable with it. I don't want to say I understand it more. I feel more comfortable with it. Things that I don't understand, things frighten you people that when they don't understand them. I also take
that's
it
exactly.
as a matter of faith. My faith is strong, so I believe that there isn't really anything to be scared of. But I also think, Albert, that one of the most fascinating things that happens in the paranormal, and I've witnessed this, is when I'm with somebody who doesn't believe, and if something happens and makes them into a believer, and that is, it's literally life-changing, and that I've experienced a few times with people.
Well, those are epiphanies that turn people to religion, too, and that's one of the big stories of religion, is when things can't be understood or can't be explained, and you said the word yourself, and I agree with you, people turn to faith.
Exactly. Right. I mean, because what is religion? How can you explain religion? A lot of people's faiths are based on what seems ludicrous or unbelievable or fascinating or magic, and most faiths are like that. Most faiths, if not all, have some sort of an afterlife or some sort of beliefs in that. And if you can't logically explain away everything.
Because that explains and comes up with the fear of the unknown. But most religions, and I mean in their different forms, I don't just mean the difference between Roman Catholics and Christians or Church of England people. I'm talking about in their wider different forms. Most religions actually look at the others and believe that they're juvenile. They don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
They're silly. It's crazy. They're nuts. That's why they fight about it so often. You're
mm-hmm.
wrong, they say to each other. You don't get it. We're right and you're wrong.
Oh, yeah, I'm Catholic. We think we're the only ones that are right.
Exactly. Because their belief systems are so different.
It's even, again, I'm saying I was raised Catholic. I was, you know, I turned away from religion completely for about 10 years of my adult life. Came back to it because I found comfort in it, and I get more out of it than I don't. But I also know that we don't know everything. You know, who's to say that my religion is right and somebody else's beliefs are wrong? That's
Absolutely.
That's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. I find comfort believing what I believe, but I know that I don't have all the answers, and I'm not always right. I don't understand everything, but not to believe in that.
Not to believe in religion?
Not to believe in anything that's beyond what we see, feel, and hear right here. To not believe in anything that has a magical connotation to it, or faith, or I just think what a sad, boring world not to believe in something greater than ourselves.
Yeah, you know what? You're right. Wouldn't it be a terrible place to live in, a world to live in, if we didn't believe in anything else?
Yeah.
Only what we currently know.
It would be sad. I think it would be
a sad,
boring place to live, and I'm glad I don't believe in that. And the way I look at it, if I'm wrong when I die, it's not going to matter, is it? If I'm wrong about all this, it doesn't matter. I won't know. I'll be dead. So,
and there's also no problem. There's also no problem having faith and belief. But this brings us back again to the urban legend. Now, I'm not applying religion to urban legends, by the way. But going back to, say, the Loch Ness Monster story, it still requires, and Bigfoot, which we've covered, it still requires somebody to drag him out of the lake and say, here he is. Look, it was true after all.
Right.
You know? But I agree with you, until that happens, why not, you know, why not believe it's possible?
Oh, I like believing in the Loch Ness Monster. It's fun. It just, you know, it brings back childhood memories of wanting to go to Loch Ness, and it makes me kind of sad to realize that, you know, most likely there is no Loch Ness Monster, because, again, it's something I like believing in that. But wanting to believe in something doesn't necessarily mean that it's true or that it's believable. But when it comes to ghosts, my personal opinions, I have no doubts. But there's so many magic things we can't understand.
Teresa, I could talk to you all day. Can we do this again?
Absolutely, I would love to.
Yes, you can. I wanted to just add, because I didn't want to interrupt, because I was blabbing so much of the rest of the show, and I'm always interested to hear what Teresa has to say, because she's very patient, typically, and I appreciate that. What we're doing, in case, I don't know, you may not know, how this whole America's Most Haunted came to be, is this is a book, and we put together the proposal, and went through that whole process. And we now have a deal with Penguin. So we're writing America's Most...
Hey, my publisher.
That's right.
Exactly. So for me, my whole underlying interest and what I hope to get out of this book writing, and already have through the first approximately a third, we're about a third of the way through, I guess, is exactly what we're talking about here. And that is, I'm trying to plot my course between self-deception and being closed-minded. I do not want to deceive myself, but I also do not want to be closed-minded. I'm trying to find my way, pick my way through, and find the kind of evidence that can support belief without going too deeply into self-deception. And that's
You know what, Eric? Let's definitely, because we're running out of time, I can see, let's definitely do this again. So I'm currently working on a book, and I've never told anybody this yet, even my publisher, but I'm calling Beware False Prophets, which is exactly the subject you're talking about. And let's come on another day and talk about all of these prophecies that have been made that haven't come true and the consequences of them.
Makes great sense. Well, we didn't end up talking about you as author nearly as much as I would have thought, but certainly fascinating conversation. Very interesting. I'm glad we let things go the way they did. But we do want to remind people that Phantom Hitchhikers and Other Urban Legends was just released here in the U.S. just last month on paperback. Very reasonable. It's a really nice little book. You can pick it up and just open it literally to any page. We didn't really talk about your 10-minute theory, but we both I think part of this is what, you know, as you know, because you were listening, we discussed the book at some length without you earlier in the week. So, but we both really enjoy the book and really I'm interested in getting a good close look at some of your other books because there are a lot of similarities there, especially certainly your mysteries book. And we definitely want to refer people to your website. Why don't you tell us what that is real quick, please?
albertjack.com.
Very simple. And I see you're on Twitter. Do you do a lot of tweeting?
Not a lot, to be honest. I'm not a great tweeter or Twitterer, but we do have a Facebook page, Albert Jack Chat. I think it's Albert Jack Chat, it's called. So you can find me there.
So we absolutely want to refer people to check you out as an author. And I know I had a very interesting and thought-provoking time. I love these kinds of discussions because it forces me to really analyze what I think and why. And ultimately, that's what this is all about. So,
do you know what, Ben? Let's do it again.
Let's do it again. I'd love to hear about this book you're working on. It's a whole other topic that is absolutely fascinating, I agree, as far as prophecies and what they mean and how often they're true, if ever, and, you know, so on and so forth. So I'm glad we finally were able to get this call in and get the show done after a number of false starts, but we were persistent. We bowled our way through it, and I'm really glad we did. It was great talking to you and getting to know you, Albert, and as always, enjoyed talking with you, Teresa, and hope everyone has a great week, and we'll be back at the normal time, which is Tuesday nights at 10 Eastern next week, and is it next week already? We have John Zaffis? I believe it is. That will be amazing.
Well, Albert, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope we talk again soon. And I'd love to chat off-air sometime, too. So I'll be contacting you on Facebook or something, okay?
I'd love that, too. Please do that.
I will. All right. Thank you, everybody. And thank you, Albert, for joining us. Have a great week.
Thank you. God bless.